If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
Yeah. It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Stories that we're following this hour and stuff that is going on. City Hall is making progress, they say, on the cybersecurity attack. Slowly things are getting back to normal. They cannot tell us a lot as far as the ransomware and the security aspect of it for obvious reasons. But things are slowly coming around and they're doing the best they can down there. And as we find out more information, we'll certainly pass that along. Same in regard to the shooting that was downtown yesterday. That investigation continues. Not a lot of information there. Dave and Jen will keep us up to date on all of that throughout the course of the afternoon. Nanos, another poll. We love the polls. This one, an update from last month. Majority of Canadians not even considering voting for the Justin Trudeau Liberals. Okay, I'll stop. But it just keeps coming. So I'm predicting. So the majority of Canadians not even considering voting for the Liberals. That is from Nanos, and I'll break that down for you. 42% who would, if we voted today, which we know we're not. And believe me, the Conservatives have more than enough runway to shoot each toe off. And let's not forget that. So 42.8% would pick the Conservatives. That's up 2.8%. The Liberals down to 23.3%. That's down 1.4%. NDP pretty much holding steady, up 0.8%. The preferred prime minister is Pierre Poilievre, 37% over JT's 19, and Jagmeet Singh below that. So there you go. That's if it was held today, but we all know it's not. So if this is the case, I'm predicting what they'll say is there's going to be a really low turnout, because if people don't like their candidate, then they just stay home. And, you know, a lot of people have said, well, we should make voting mandatory. Well, you know, in a sense, you're making a statement by staying home. Not that I encourage that in any way. I encourage everyone to get information on all of the candidates and then make an intelligent choice that suits you and get out and cast your ballot. But people not showing up to the polls, it's kind of, well, nobody showed up this time. Well, no, just people for the guy that lost didn't show up. The people for the guy that won or the girl that won, they all showed up because they gave that person the win. So who didn't show up when people complain of a low voter turnout is their team didn't show up. And for many people, rather than voting for, you know, if you're traditionally left or right or this or that, it doesn't matter. But if your person doesn't do it for you and you're just frankly upset with them and, you know, there's no way you can possibly vote for any other candidate, then you stay home. It's how democracy works. So, again, I don't encourage that in any way. Let's get everybody out to vote, no matter who you're voting for. But the point is, it's people who are disinterested in their candidate, not only in the election, in their candidate, that they don't show up and support that candidate. So it'll be interesting to see how that, all moves forward. What else we got? More on the ArriveCan debacle. Millions going out to shady companies, including government staffers. Now that takes balls, doesn't it? I'm going to apply to my own government, who I'm working for, and I'm going to scoop out lots of cash. And, you know, God bless them. I guess we don't know what they did is legal or illegal, because we just don't find that sort of stuff out from this government. But it's continuing. And the prime minister said today, well, he's blaming a civil service procedure. Of course, because he doesn't take any of the blame for anything. And it still amazes me that so many civil service people can be blamed when the civil service is bloated since he started, increasing by over 30%. So I don't know what all the people are doing. Clearly not doing the things that they're supposed to be doing. And I don't know, at the end of the day, doesn't that fall on the general manager of the Walmart, not necessarily the greeter. All right, what else we got? Sweden joining NATO. Hooray, good for them. So I guess that's good news for Ukraine moving forward. Hamilton Police Service. And again, we were talking about earlier the shooting yesterday and no new real information on that. But we were chatting about yesterday, the shooting response unit has been made permanent. We're going to talk more about that with Hamilton Police and give you a little bit more detail. Also, you might remember Merritt Stiles was on yesterday's show from the provincial NDP and saying that the provincial government, since 407 has defaulted on its payments that it owes the provincial government, that they should use that to leverage to get truckers' tolls dropped on the 407. It sounds like a brilliant idea, but I don't think it's legal because we've been down this road before. If it is, I'm all in. But I'm not sure it is, and we're going to talk to Dr. Ian Lee from Carleton University to see what his thought is on all of this. And, you know, as things just keep getting more and more and more expensive, and, man, you can just feel the frustration when you're out at the grocery store or anyway. You know what I'm feeling, and you know what I'm talking about. And so how about getting a carbon fee on your pizza? Goodfellas Wood Oven Pizza Chain is pairing the two. So as they become more, I guess, carbon conscious, they're adding that to your pizza. So if they need a new ventilation system or something that's a little bit more environmental friendly, they just add a little bit more to the pie. How do you feel about that? We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Obviously, everyone concerned about gun crime and what is happening not only in this city, but many cities across the country. And of course, experiencing that again yesterday in the afternoon with another fatal shooting. The Hamilton Police Service's shooting response team has been made permanent. To discuss what that is all about, let's bring in Detective Sergeant Steve Barazuk of the Hamilton Police Service, oversees the shooting response team and here now. Steve, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I know, Detective, there's only so much you can say in regard to this. Is there anything more you can add to or any message you want to say about what happened yesterday in downtown?
No, I think the only thing I can add right now is that certainly the homicide unit and detectives involved in that case and that investigation are working very diligently at it. They've obviously been working some long hours since the incident yesterday afternoon. It's a particular incident that I think it's fair to say it shocked the community. It's a brazen daylight shooting. Again, something that's completely unacceptable and should not be accepted as the norm in this city. And we're going to do our absolute best to hold those accountable who are involved in that.
All right. What is the objective of the Hamilton Police Service's shooting response unit?
It's probably just as it sounds. The shooting response unit was developed after 1 year of a pilot, and that was in response to increased shootings that we've seen over the past certainly the past 4 years. So what we did was we took a couple detectives from different areas of the service, and we put them together into a shooting team to address non-lethal shootings in the city because they are on the increase. They're very serious, and oftentimes the type of investigations involve uncooperative either victims and or witnesses for a number of reasons. And this team is solely dedicated to shooting investigations, which afford them some time and space to be able to diligently investigate them. So we are able to solve cases even if a victim or witnesses are uncooperative.
So would it be safe to say, Steve, that this unit deals with the gun crime that doesn't fall into the homicide unit?
Yeah, absolutely. This unit's going to investigate, generally speaking, all things shooting. That's where a firearm has been discharged, whether it's a non-lethal injury or whether there are reckless shootings in the sense that a stray bullet or whatnot has not struck a person, but perhaps a place or a thing. They're going to investigate that as well.
Obviously, when something happens like happened yesterday, that resonates. Everybody hears that story somehow, some way. So I'm guessing there's a lot more that goes on that doesn't result in the same, it doesn't have the same result as yesterday, but it still is obviously very concerning. Is there a lot of this?
Well, there, again, shootings are on the increase, and I can tell you to give you some numbers. And last year, in 2023, there were 35 shootings across the city. 21 of those were ultimately investigated by the shooting response team pilot. 45 shootings in 2022, 39 in 2021. To give you some numbers for homicides, we were hitting record numbers in homicides in 2020 and 2021 with 17 and 19. I mean, a lot of times it's by the good fortune of real quality medical care in the city. We are blessed to have a number of quality hospitals, generally speaking, close by, and the paramedics and doctors do wonders. And you're absolutely right. The numbers could be much higher. Thankfully, they're not. But regardless, they're still far, far too high, and they're simply unacceptable.
Wow, that's something, Steve, when you're saying, thank goodness we've got a great hospital system and EMS staff to help with all of this. So this not a pilot anymore, what does that mean now? What happens?
So this is now, I commend the Hamilton Police Service for creating this unit and making it a full-time unit. It's staffed by one sergeant and three detective constables, and they have started full-time this year, starting in January. It's a brand-new team. We have some quality investigators on this particular team. It's led by Sergeant Matt Dugdale, and they are going to continue to investigate these ongoing shootings that occur, non-lethal shootings. And we've had 10 so far this year. One obviously yesterday was fatal, and the unit's currently has 9 cases for this year.
I understand other large cities have similar units.
I understand Toronto. Also, I've learned that Toronto police have a similar unit. I'm not aware of any other police service outside of Toronto, but there very well could be, and certainly it would make sense because these types of incidences are on an increase certainly across the province. So I wouldn't really be surprised if other police services are following suit. But I'm certainly glad here in Hamilton that we are. I think it's really important, and I think that we have to take a stance on gun crime in the city, and we have to work hard at investigating these and try to arrest the people that have guns. I mean, it's just not something that should be okay.
Will the public notice anything different here? What's the message to them?
What I would ask the public, I think they're not. I don't know if they're going to necessarily notice anything different. I think we will do our best to obviously put the information out when we have the cases. We're looking for public support. I think oftentimes when we have shootings, the difficulty is corralling witnesses into these cases, and that's for a number of reasons. And most often, fear of retaliation or criminal involvement by themselves prohibit them from speaking to us. But what I want to do is encourage people that if they see something, please reach out to our unit. Let us help, because we require it can be a partnership, and we require the assistance of the community when it comes to these types of incidences and crime to help solve them. We have tools at our disposal to try to go at it alone, but it's certainly much more effective when we have the help from the community. And that's what I would plead for today is please help us, and we can certainly get the job done much quicker.
Detective Sergeant Steve Barazuk with us, Hamilton Police Service Shooting Response Team. It has now been made permanent. Steve, thanks so much for everyone on the service, for everything you and everyone on the service does to keep us safe. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
We were talking to Merritt Stiles, who's head of the Ontario NDP, yesterday, and she was talking about how, in order to alleviate congestion on the 401, that we should allow truckers to drive the 407 toll-free, which sounds like a brilliant idea, and really the whole reason the 407 was built was to alleviate the congestion on the 401. However, when it gets tolled into oblivion, nobody takes it, which is where we are now. And we've also, I think, been here before, because the McGuinty government tried to take this company to court in the past for tolls, because again, the original piece, the majority of the 407 is privately owned. It's Pickering East that isn't, and certainly a much less congested piece of the road. So is it worth reopening? Can we reopen this case? Because apparently 407 owes the province money. Let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Ian, thank you for your time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Scott.
I'm sure you're old enough as well to remember the first time around when government tried to sue this company or somehow take this company into court to change the tolling. Is there something that can be done here? Does Merit Styles have a wedge, have some leverage here?
The only way I studied this whole question, not the 407 per se, when I was doing my PhD in the 1980s, it was a period of very fascinating intellectual ferment, but real world practical stuff, because this was the time when Thatcher was privatizing and deregulating in England, and Mulroney was doing it in Canada, privatized CN, privatized Air Canada. And there were all kinds of papers being written by the Economic Council of Canada. It was really a fascinating time. And I really got turned on to this stuff, believe it or not. I read up everything I possibly could. And, you know, because there's arguments on both sides. I mean, in the abstract, you know, government ownership, private ownership. Society, Canada, a consensus emerged that governments should, by and large, not be in the operating businesses in the private sector. Their role is to regulate, my metaphor, regulate the hockey game, not tell Sidney Crosby when to shoot the puck. And so we did a lot of privatization and deregulation. Fair enough. But then you come under the rule of law. We are a rule of law country. Private property is respected. This is not Putin's Russia, where Putin can just say, I'm taking your property, whether you like it or not. And I think, and I'm saying this not to be provocative, but I think the NDP is simply forgetting this. The 407, you've already said it, but I'll say it even more bluntly. The 407 is just as private property as my house is in Ottawa. Now, the NDP or no government can start legislating, well, you know, Ian's got a big house and we're just going to order him to take in some tenants because, well, he's got some extra space. It's none of their business. It's my house. It's private property. The 407 is private property. Now, to your question, though, Scott, is there anything they can do? I'm not trying to tell you or suggest to anyone listening that governments are helpless. There is an act of parliament and an act of every one of the 10 provincial legislatures, and it's called the Expropriation Act, part of the rule of law, and it spells out and codifies all the rules. If you want to expropriate and take a government, we're talking government, wants to seize property, they can do it. There is legislation to lawfully do it, but then they've got to pay market value, whether the NDP like it or not. That's the rules of the game that we've evolved over, oh my goodness, 40 or 50 or 60 years about expropriation.
And so you basically buy it back.
You buy it back. Or because this idea that there's a choice of governing instruments that government faces, they can go to 407 owners and say, we want to pay you money to subsidize these wealthy trucking companies driving down the 407 for free. In other words, we can do corporate welfare. Now, I'm just going to make a sidebar comment here. Okay. I kind of thought, I had an old-fashioned idea about the NDP. I thought they were out for the little guy or the little person. I didn't know that they were on the side of subsidizing rich, powerful corporations like trucking companies. And so then we can have a really good debate. Is this the most appropriate expenditure of public funds when we have desperate lineups in healthcare? Believe me, I'm on the receiving end of that right now. I won't go into my details, but I'm waiting. I'm on a queue for some elective surgery. And so is this the most appropriate way to expend public funds to subsidize wealthy truckers to drive down the 407 who are choosing their full volition, choosing not to pay the toll so they can't use the road? So now the NDP is saying, well, we want them to use the roads. So either they're proposing nationalizing, expropriating the 407, or they're advocating that we are going to, the taxpayer is going to subsidize the owners of the 407 to allow the trucks to drive for free, because they're not going to let them drive for free.
Merit Styles yesterday said, Ian, that the 407 owes Ontario money. This would be a good time to leverage that.
You know, she's probably sounding, forgive me for saying something so provocative. She's sounding almost like Putin. We can do whatever we want. No. We are a rule of law country. That means just because a politician jumps up and says, seize this and seize that, it's almost like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. you know, she walked around and off with his head, off with his head.
Well, we're not in Alice in Wonderland, people. We're in Canada. We have a constitution, you know, we have a Supreme Court. And you just can't arbitrarily say to a company that owes you money or a debtor, you know what? I'm going to seize your assets. You just can't do that. You go delinquent on your credit card. They can't just show up and say, you know what? I'm taking your house. We do have laws in this country, people. We do have a rule of law. We do have a charter of rights. And you can't just go and seize somebody's assets because, oh, well, they owe me money. And maybe they're not even delinquent. So then what's your excuse? And if you are delinquent, there's a provision to sue in the courts and sue for monies that are owed to you. But you can't just seize somebody's property because they owe you money and they're not paying you back. That's how banana republics work. That's how corrupt third world countries like Russia work. But we don't operate like that in Canada.
Isn't the 413, just to deviate here, take an off ramp, isn't the 413 really just above the 407? I mean, when you think about it, the 401 will be below it, then the 407, then the 403 going across the top to the 400, and eventually taken to the 115, exactly like the 407. So they're literally having a highway above it to take the stress off the 401.
I understand. And by the way, I don't live down there, but I drive the 401, I assure you. I just came back from Las Vegas to see you two, and my flight arrived late, missed my connecting flight, couldn't go to the next day, but I had a class the next morning, so I rented a car from Pearson and drove through the middle of the night down the 401. And my goodness me, the 401 is congested, I learned, even at 11:30 at night around Pearson and through Toronto. It was incredible. And so I understand what people are saying. I feel their pain, I really do, because it's nowhere near as bad as that in Ottawa. But all that means is that there is a need, contra my famous progressive green friends, there's a need for more roads.
Because that's what I said to Merritt. I said that to Merritt Stiles. Wouldn't the solution here just be to build more?
That's my answer. That is my answer. We've talked about this before, Scott. I want to get out very quickly. On the one hand, people support immigration. I support immigration. I've always supported immigration. But then some people turn around and say, but I don't want to accept the consequences of Canada getting bigger. We don't want to build more houses at the edges in the suburbs. We don't want to build more hospitals. We don't want to build more sidewalks. Well, you know, we've got to face reality and be grown up about this and mature. If we're going to grow the population significantly, which we are, I support it. Well, then we have to face the music. We've got to build more roads. We've got to build more schools. We've got to build more hospitals. And we've got to expand on the boundaries of the edges of the city. And that means more 401s, 407s, 413 highways, because the population is getting bigger. And remember, the largest number of immigrants every year go straight to the GTA. They're not going, that's the number one source, destination for immigrants. They're not coming to Ottawa. I mean, they are, but much smaller numbers. They're not going to Halifax. They're going to the GTA. They love the GTA. Okay, fair enough. You are going to have to deal with that success in the GTA and not stick your hands over your eyes and say, I refuse to look at the consequences of the population growing much more rapidly. So that's my criticism of the NDP on this, is that they're not confronting the reality on the ground that we are growing very rapidly, and we must deal with that reality in terms of housing, in terms of roads, in terms of hospitals, and so forth. All the other things that we need, because we are growing very quickly.
Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. As always, Ian, thank you for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
A Toronto area restaurant chain is charging all customers a carbon fee on each and every bill. Goodfellow's Wood Oven Pizzas say that they are now adding a 2% carbon fee onto all orders. It says at the bottom of its receipt, the chain shares the reasoning for the charge, saying, "What we eat fuels climate change. Adding 2% to every restaurant bill to invest in carbon capture will help offset our carbon footprint." Talk more about all of this. Moshe Lander with us, senior economics lecturer, Concordia University. And here now, Moshe, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you very much.
Moshe, your thoughts. Surprised? Have you heard of this a lot?
I haven't heard of it a lot. I was surprised to see it, but I'm happy to see it. It's about time that people recognize that we don't have to wait for federal carbon taxes to to decide to do our part to try and represent the true cost that's involved in any production process. So whether 2% is the right number or not, they can always adjust it, but I applaud them for it.
Many might say you can also always adjust it, kind of like they are with tips, which used to be 10%, then 12, then 15, now 18, 20, 25. How does how will the customer react, do you think?
Well, it depends on how it's presented to the customer. If their customer base are generally more environmental friendly and accommodating of understanding what's involved here, it probably shouldn't affect them much. In fact, it might even draw people in that say, well, I'm glad somebody's taking this approach and I want to give my money to somebody who believes in the same things that I do. It's entirely possible, of course. People say, I'm already upset with the rising cost of food and living, and this is just maybe a cash grab, and I don't know that I really believe them, and I'm going to take my business elsewhere. It's going to become an exercise in marketing this and trying to be clear about how they're collecting that money and to show that they're using that money to offset their carbon footprint.
That was my next question, Moshe. How do you know that's where the money's going? Do they have to prove that in any way?
I would. I think it's a rather harmless sort of exercise. So even if you say that you're taking that 2% add-on and all you're going to do is just go and plant trees with this, then okay, I feel better that at least it's not going into some owner's pocket or that it's being used to steer money elsewhere. But again, that's an issue of this restaurant should be having conversations with its regular customer base and trying to get the message out there that this is not a cash grab. This is not the same thing as changing tips from 15 to 18% and trying to use it to pay the staff more money. And I think, again, if the feedback from the customers is we're good with this, it shouldn't harm them. And part of it then is how much conviction do they have that this is the right way to go? That are they prepared to lose customers over this for something that they believe in that strongly?
But they don't have to display or show that that's where the money's going. Like, for example, if you go to an LCBO, they might be collecting money for a specific charity. They would have to put forward how much their donations are. I mean, this is really the same thing, except they're adding it to you. They're making the decision for you to make that donation.
Correct. The analogy that I guess I would make here is, if you fly, Air Canada will say, would you like to add on an extra little bit of money to offset your carbon footprint? And depending on where you're flying, they tell you how much that money is. They don't have to show that that money is actually being used for anything other than going to their bottom line. But in this case, too, they could just be adding it and not necessarily having to show that it's being added to their bottom line. Again, if it were to emerge that they were taking this extra money and they were just putting it into their pocket, I think that would be way more damaging than not doing it at all. Doing it and giving it to where it actually belongs. So I'd be highly suspicious that a company is going to do this and risk all of the negative backlash that would come where they're pocketing this cash and not even doing the productive thing that they said they would.
Should it be a choice for the customer? I guess it is because they don't have to go to Goodfellas.
And that's exactly it. It's if you believe strongly about this, I might even be looking to try and expand my clientele then. I'm the company that cares about the environment, and we use a production process that is very environmentally unfriendly. I don't want to out the company and discuss the way that they do it, but if you read the article, you saw that, yeah, that's probably not good for the environment. So the fact that they're taking this approach is maybe saying that, look, we understand that you're enjoying the food that we provide and the way that which we make it, but we do understand that there are consequences to this. And if we're contributing, then we want to do our part. And it's no different than any other company that tries to take that social responsibility by either donating money to causes they believe in or that they want their customers to believe in. I think, again, that the backlash from misleading the customer would be so much more devastating than implementing this policy and doing it responsibly or just not doing it at all.
I'm just not sure, Moshe, everyone has the time and the energy to do that sort of investigating, or they'll just go to another pizza place. Moshe Lander with a senior economics lecturer with Concordia University. Moshe, as always, thank you so much for your time. Be well.
Anytime.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
So Will and I heard this story and we were debating whether to include it on the show because It's sort of a sign of the times, but then not necessarily a positive sign of the times. But then maybe it sort of explains the depth of some of the frustration people are feeling with various things in a post-pandemic world. This happened in a Peterborough cemetery gravestone, family gravestone, where they purchased the big one. And as members check in, they put their dates on the gravestone, but the names are already there. Well, one family member didn't want to be associated with a family, so went into the cemetery and chiseled their name off of the family stone. And, of course, as a result, police called and a charge laid. Steve Jordan's with us, professor of psychology, University of Toronto, here now. Steve, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be with you. Let's see where we go with this one.
Well, that's my point here, Steve. I don't know if I feel good or bad about talking about this because, you know, you don't want to exploit a family that's having a tough time. On the other hand, is there a learning moment here, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have to start by saying we really do not understand the underlying motivations or the whole story. And in fact, there could be a couple of stories. And depending on the story, there may be different things to learn. You know, the most obvious first thought is that this person was having some real disagreement with their family, and they were actually distancing themselves from the family. But another potential that just came up in a conversation I had with a friend of mine is that, you know, we live in a world where a lot of people who are trans, especially, sort of change their identity in life. They see themselves as a completely different person, and often that involves changing a name. And therefore, you know, one of the worst thoughts for such a person might be seeing that name that you no longer associate with on that gravestone for the rest of eternity. So, you know, it could be something, and those are very different, and it could be both. You know, it could be that the trans issue has potentially caused a rift in the family, and maybe there's a little bit of both going on there.
Wow, I never even thought of that angle, Steve, but that's why you're the psychologist, and I'm not.
Okay,
but
I'm going to come clean on this. It was a chat with Will, so it's your producer.
Wow.
So I have to give Will credit for that idea. Yeah,
all right.
Take credit for that.
You know, again, never thought of that angle, but certainly, you know, whatever it is, let's talk about the action. Is that extreme action, that type of extreme action, something that we see more of in a difficult time, such as we're going through now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly a reflection of how deep the divisions have gone and to the point where they can really come between family members. And this isn't even, you know, we're using words like extreme, but I think if we were in a room of 200 and said, how many of you have a major rift with a family member that developed from sort of pandemic days? And I suspect there would be a whole lot more hands go up than we think. You know, what used to be something we saw where somebody became estranged, you know, that used to be something that was very dramatic in movies, right? You were disowning you or whatever. I don't know. I think it's much more common. And it is kind of scary. And yes, this is an extreme act, but I wonder if the situation underlying it isn't, in fact, way more common than it should be. And it's kind of sad because our families should be, you know, our primary support. They should be the ones we can count on always. And when they're not, you know, that can really, really mess somebody up. And I think that's the situation we have in this case.
You talked about the pandemic, and we all know, we all lived through it and what that experience was like for each of us, no matter what your situation, your age, what have you. I mean, we all had an experience with that. Do you think this is still pandemic related? This is still us coming out of this?
Yeah, I do, because, you know, I used to say, you know, as we were coming out of the pandemic, that there's all these conspiracy theories around, and I would be advising people that if your family member is, you know, one of these people who's embraced these, to not do a victory lap, you know, if they turn out not to be true, and to not put it in their face, because I had hoped those divisions would just sort of fade away, you know, as we got back to normalcy. They don't seem to be fading away. I'm sorry, I have a train going past me. I'm not sure if you can hear it right now.
We can hear you fine, Steve. So in some sense, has this empowered people to stand up for what they believe?
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like such a positive spin. I wish people were more empowered to embrace the shades of gray. And what I mean by that is we've been so pushed into the black and white, and it seems like impossible now for people to say, you know, I kind of get where you're coming from, but I'm kind of here for this reason. And that's where almost every issue should be, right? There's very few issues that are black and white. Yeah. And it's just sort of how you weigh the things that should determine where you're at. Now, I did want to add one thing from a psychology geek point of view. This behavior that we're talking about, removing your name from the gravestone, it's an amazing example where you've heard me talk before about how something, when you feel threatened or angry or whatever, it kicks in the fight-flight system.
Yeah.
This is an example of a behavior that's kind of both. We usually talk about fight or flight. You choose to fight or you choose to flee. This person is doing a very, you know, sort of aggressive act by chiseling this thing off. He's clearly an angry, I'm assuming a male individual here, but clearly angry. Clearly there's a lot of fight in them. And yet the fight is to flee the family. So
yeah,
sort of simultaneously, we see both of these reflexes in play. And from a psychology geek point of view, that's kind of interesting.
You know, think of it as, well, somebody gets a tattoo of somebody's name, a partner's name, and then the partner's not there. They get the tattoo removed. I don't know. Do you think this has, and you know, again, if I'm going down a road, pull me back, Steve, but a rabbit hole or whatever. But do you think this has to do with mandates? You tell people they have to do something. Yeah. All of a sudden, their opinion changes. I mean, you know, and I go to the vaccine mandate. We were all well on our way to getting vaccinated. We had the vast majority that did, certainly for the first round anyway. And then, boom, you have to do this. That's what seemed to pit family member against family member.
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, you're not down any rabbit hole at all. In fact, you're down one of the major theories of human motivation. And it says there's three components that you have to respect. The first one is called autonomy. And that is, people will embrace something if they see the value for themselves and if they choose to do it. But if you force them to do it, the moment somebody says, you must do that, you know, we tend to have two letters pop up in our head, F and U. And they just, they're right there. And that's just a knee-jerk reaction. It almost doesn't, you know, hey, you must take this $20. We almost want to say, no, we're not. You're absolutely right. This is a primitive of human behavior. We do not like being told what to do. And I think the government kind of learned that even when they tried to justify why the mandate was in place, the justification didn't matter because the emotionality was already triggered by the command, so to speak. And humans do not like that. So you're 100% correct there.
And another avenue to this, Steve, if you tell somebody they need something to survive and then you tell them we don't have it, there's a shortage of it and you have to line up by age, they're going to be jumping on board to get vaccinated. But we're plumb out of time, Steve. We will continue this discussion. Steve Jordan's with us, professor of psychology, University of Toronto. Fascinating. A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You certainly remember the two Michaels, Michael Spavor, Michael Kovrig. They were detained in China when we, meaning Canada, detained a Huawei CEO, royalty, on part of an international warrant. China's response was to take the two Michaels. And for 3 years, they were detained. Well, Michael Spavor reportedly has reached a multi-million-dollar settlement, about $6 million with the federal government. Charles Burton with us, Senior Fellow, Center for Advancing Canada's Interest Abroad at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. Charles, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, and I hope you are too, Scott, on this sunny, beautiful spring-like day.
I know. It's we've been getting a lot of spring, which is really nice. So why do the two Michaels get money, or at least one here? Is this the government's fault? Why do they get money from the government here?
Well, I think certainly Michael Kovrig has not said whether he received any compensation yet. He had previously said that he was looking for compensation that would just cover, you know, the costs that he lost while in Chinese incarceration hell for 3 years. Michael Spavor is a bit different. He believes that if it hadn't been for the government having a program called the Global Security Reporting Program that Mr. Kovrig had been part of, that he would not have been subject to the imprisonment. So we don't know the terms for the money that he's been given, and they, you know, the $6 or $7 million is just unofficial that we've heard from sources that probably shouldn't be talking about it. And evidently, Mr. Spavor is under a non-disclosure agreement in this regard and is only allowed to say that the matter has been resolved. But the gist of it seems to be that Spavor was not aware that Mr. Kovrig would be handing over information about Kovrig's conversations with Spavor to intelligence agencies in Canada and abroad. And the Chinese, becoming aware of this, then identified Mr. Spavor as a spy being run by Mr. Kovrig, and that's why they sentenced him to 11 years. Kovrig was released with Mr. Spavor before Kovrig had been sentenced. So it does seem to call into question whether Global Affairs was managing this global security reporting program properly, and if this kind of operation was seen by the Chinese as intelligence gathering, inconsistent with the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations that says that diplomats should not be engaged in unlawful activities to gather information, or whether they should have been leaving, you know, the spying to the professional spies with the training and the ability to protect sources better than what Mr. Spavor suggests happened. So it looks like another cover-up of shortcomings in Canada's management of our relations with China yet again. And, you know, the fact that the government has handed over this huge chunk of money suggests, you know, because Mr. Spavor was threatening to go to court and bring this all out in the open, suggests the government feels that they are culpable for not managing this properly and that they bear some responsibility for Spavor's incarceration. The Prime Minister today has said that the Chinese shouldn't say that this is proof that Spavor was in fact a spy, you know, that it still was arbitrary detention. But, you know, one can see why the Chinese would be making hay out of the fact that Spavor has been awarded such compensation.
So obviously there must be a certain amount of validity to what Spavor's saying if he's got a settlement like this and it never went to court.
Looks like that, you know, and certainly I think a lot of people have been questioning this global security reporting program as being unprofessional and endangering contacts, because the people who are doing it just don't have the training to act in a capacity that looks more and more like intelligence gathering. And there seems to have been some access to classified information by these Global Affairs Canada diplomats who were involved in this global security reporting program. You know, I had the function that Mr. Kovrig had in the political section at the Canadian Embassy in Beijing before this program was started. And certainly when I was a diplomat in China, I was very much aware of the importance of not endangering anybody that I was in contact with by doing things that would get them into terrible trouble. I think we all bear responsibility not to endanger others in the service of Canada.
Boy, we've never had this discussion before, Charles. All right. What if one gets money, are we just to assume the other does too?
My guess would be, and, you know, we have no basis for knowing it, is that Kovrig doesn't get as much. But, you know, Kovrig isn't saying, and the basis for Spavor's money, which the government won't talk about because of, you know, they say it's confidential personnel information, is not clear. But, you know, I think that the government is acknowledging a degree of culpability with regard to Spavor. Kovrig returning to China without diplomatic cover, you know, he was working for an NGO out of Belgium at the time of his arrest, and he did not have a Canadian diplomatic passport at that time, has been criticized that he should have known better than to, having been part of this global security reporting program, that he shouldn't have gone back to China unless he had a diplomatic passport. But Mr. Kovrig is adamant that he never did anything wrong and that the Chinese approved of his activities in China. That's what he says.
So is Kovrig partially responsible, or is it just the system, the government system within he was working?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Mr. Kovrig, you know, was working in his function, and he was supervised by Guy Saint-Jacques and others in, you know, in global affairs. And so if there is culpability, then I think we have to look at everybody involved and the nature of this program. and should be responding accordingly. And if there's anyone who's accountable for having engaged in practices that are not consistent with diplomatic practice, that they should be made accountable, and that the program should be assessed in a way that allows it to ensure that it's functioning in ways that won't lead to further arrests. I mean, the arrest of Kevin Garrett back in 2014, the Dandong coffee house owner, who was also subjected to almost as long period of incarceration, the same place where Spavor was held, is also apparently being attributed to his contacts with one of Mr. Kovrig's predecessors in the Global Security Reporting Program. But there again, I say we don't have enough information. It did not go to court, and it's not coming out publicly because evidently Mr. Spavor has agreed not to talk about it in exchange for under the terms of the settlement that was made.
So no more about their side of the story, no book, none of that, obviously. Did we pay anything to Huawei royalty for what we did here? I mean, was there any money exchange with the Huawei CEO?
As far as I know, but as far as I know, she maintains her two mansions in Vancouver. I don't think she needs any money. I think she's doing okay.
All right, Charles Burton with us, Senior Fellow, Center for Advancing Canada's Interest Abroad at the MacDonald Laurier Institute. Michael Spavor, one of the two Michaels, reportedly reaching a multi-million dollar settlement with the federal government over his detainment in China. Charles, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Good to speak with you, Scott.
All right, we're going to bring in our favorite security guy. The Emergencies Act remains unchanged. Recommendations made. Lots of study, and we're going to look at this. I don't know. This all kind of seems like a joke now, considering the protests that are happening in major cities across country in regard to pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel protests. Imagine if those in the convoy did what we're seeing on the streets of Montreal and Toronto. Then we may need an Emergencies Act. But let's bring in Phil Gursky, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst, and here now. Phil, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm your favorite security guy. You're making me blush, Scott.
You are. You always show up. We love you for that, and give us your honest opinion. But let me ask you this, Phil. Like, if what had happened or what we've seen happen with demonstrations, protests, pro-Palestinian protests, anti-Israel protests in major Canadian cities, what if something like that was to replace the bouncy castles of the Freedom Convoy?
Yeah, you raise a really good point. And I think what the really important aspect of this, Scott, is a precedent has been set. So look, I live in Ottawa, although I wasn't downtown for the protests a couple of years ago. Sure, they were a pain in the you-know-where. They were disruptive. But as CSIS said, they were not a threat to national security. No one was being, accosted. No one was being assaulted. No one was being attacked. Yet they still, rolled out the act. And as Judge Mosley found that was illegal. There was no necessity to bring the act in. So you're absolutely right. If you rolled it out for that, then why shouldn't you roll it out for pro-Palestinian protests in Toronto, Montreal? I don't think you should, by the way. I don't think it's a national security threat either. But the problem is that you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you're going to justify the act for one thing, you got to at least be consistent down the road. And that's the danger of using it in the first place.
It sounds like we thought initially they were going to go and follow a lot of the recommendations or most of them. Now they're sort of pulling back on this. This is all going to get lost in the sauce in the everyday scandal, is it not?
Yep. And how much did this whole thing cost us, Scott? The inquiry, the reviews, that kind of thing. Now, in fairness to the government, I mean, yeah, some of the reforms maybe, in fact, have already been put in place by law enforcement. There were some recommendations for law enforcement, mostly to do with sharing of information, sharing of intelligence, being on the same page. But again, it begs the question, why'd you bother having an inquiry if it's never your intention to implement the recommendations at the end of the day? It's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's a waste of our collective time.
Again, this still, the Freedom Convoy making its way through the court system and such. Are you confident that if this was to happen again, it would be dealt with in a timely manner? Is Ottawa any safer now, any more organized than it was when this all happened?
Well, first of all, it never was a safety issue. I mean, my colleagues at CSIS said that categorically. We looked at these wankers, You know, they couldn't organize a piss up in a bar for the most part, and they weren't a threat to national security. Yes, it was inconvenient, but it wasn't a threat to national security. So it's not really much a safety issue. I like to think that, you know, any organization, law enforcement included, can learn from what happened. So some things didn't go well in terms of, you know, assigning responsibility to various forces. Bear in mind, too, Scott, you had at least three jurisdictions at play, right? You had Ottawa City Police, you had the OPP, and you had the RCMP. Now you've got three different, you know, levels of jurisdiction. So yeah, you can learn lessons about what you should have done better and that kind of thing. But no, I mean, for a government that, you know, ignores intelligence at the best of times and then uses it when it's convenient, yeah. I'm not that confident it's going to go better next time this thing happens.
A lot of people, let's switch gears here back to the protests. A lot of people are raising concern over the police and their inability to have control over this and it getting out of hand. What are your thoughts? What should we be doing to keep a handle on this? We know protests are legal, but it's turned into intimidation.
Yeah, and you raise a really good point. You know, it's funny. I was just talking to Chris Lewis the other day. He, of course, is a former OPP commissioner. He's a good friend of mine. And he says, you know, when you're in law enforcement and you're faced with a situation like that, you got to be careful what you do. If you go in, you know, batons waving and all that kind of stuff, you can make a bad situation worse. So what we need, of course, is police to be resourced properly so they can handle these types of situations so they don't get out of hand. And, you know, we have to have responsibility accepted by the so-called leadership of these protests so that, you know, yes, you have a charter right to protest. No, you don't have a charter right to shut down a business because you don't like them. So I think there's responsibility on all sides. And yeah, we're going to see more protests, whether it's Gaza or something else down the road. But yeah, as long as you do it properly in accordance with the law, you have that right. But no, you don't have the right to disturb people's lives beyond a reasonable extent, I would say.
In your opinion, have police been handling this correctly?
It's hard for me to say. You know, I'm the last guy to want to criticize police, only because I wasn't a policeman. I haven't walked the walk that they have, although I did work for the OPP for a while. Again, you know, they're placed in a tough position. They don't do anything to blame. They come down too hard, they're blamed. So you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I would rather say, I'd rather make sure the police are adequately resourced. They have the intelligence in advance as to where the protest is going to be. Maybe they can, you know, they can parade people into a certain area where they won't be as disruptive. But yeah, I'm really reluctant to say the cops are at fault here.
Adequately resourced, what does that mean?
Well, in terms of money and personnel, we know that I know for a fact that, you know, the RCMP is hurting for recruits. I'm sure the OPP and local law enforcement are hurting for recruits. We've had defund the police movement, Scott, in this country. People want to get rid of police in the first place. Yeah. So how is it you can say that police forces no longer perform the job they're supposed to and then blame the police for not doing the job that they're saying? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. So, you know, public safety and national security are important. They have to be adequately resourced. And if that means taking money from other things, then maybe that's what the governments have to do.
Phil Gursky, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst on the Emergencies Act and everything else security related. Phil, as always, thank you so much for the time. Be well.
If any consolation, you're my favorite radio host as well, Scott.
Yeah, sure. Just when I'm listening. Thank you, buddy. Much appreciated.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
New Léger polling conducted for the National Post found that many Canadians think, yes, that Canada is broken and that they're angry with the Prime Minister. And this kind of started with a tagline that Pierre Poilievre had, you know, started saying that Canada's broken. And then everybody started to, you know, defending, no, it's not broken. It's the best place to live in the world. And then when this keeps going on and on and on and on and one screw up, after another, and scandal in the same old, how many committees do we have going on to follow all this crap? It's no wonder that that is now starting to resonate with people. And if it's certainly not the country that's broken, it must be the government. And is that not one and the same? Andrew Enns is with us, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger. And here now, Andrew, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well. Thanks, Scott. Good to be back on your program.
Does the fact that we're saying Canada is broken, does that mean that the line that once was thought up by Pierre Poilievre and his people is resonating with Canadians? Because this seems to be a big debate now, whether Canada is broken or not.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as you noted in your commentary, I mean, the Pierre Poilievre was using that line a lot a little over a year ago, and to the point where, as you pointed out, we decided to test it in terms of what Canadians thought, and it generated a lot of buzz. Then we found 67% of Canadians agreed with what he was saying, that everything in Canada feels broken. He stopped using that, I think anyway, Scott. I think certainly some of the conversations continued, but I think as the leader of the opposition, he's moved on to sort of other things, and he's doesn't use that as much. But the folks at the National Post wanted to see is it still holding true, and so we tested it again, and this time we're up at 70% of Canadians feel everything in the country feels broken. And, now I think the issue is that if you're the government that will be running for re-election in, with a year, maybe 18 months from now, that's not a great, sort of backdrop to be running, against.
Yeah.
You're in charge.
Is it the line that's resonating, or the fact that there's just so much incompetence, one thing it seems after another, that this is building up and it has become a reality?
I think it's a bit of both. I think certainly there's still things going on in the country that just doesn't seem right. I think a lot when we poked on a few other questions, and I think people are sort of equating how expensive things have gotten and how hard it is and how it feels like maybe they're falling a bit behind in terms of standard of living. They're equating that to things not working right in the country. I think also whether or not things aren't working as well, there doesn't seem to be just a lot of positive things going on. I give I accept the fact that when you're in government, you have to deal with the issues that come before you. And sometimes they're not always good issues to be dealing with. I think of the wars that they're having to manage and things like that. But it's really, I think, a situation where the government just, there's not a lot of real positive things that are resonating into the public mindset that's changing minds, that things are getting better in the country. So, a year later, 67% a year ago, or 70% now. Like it just seems more of the same.
Is it really about the country that's broken or the government of the day? Because whenever people make these accusations that the country's broken, instead of defending the government of the day, they'll say, no, Canada's great. Look at this. Look at that. Yeah. We have this. And Canada obviously still is a great country. I don't think that's the point here. It's what's happened. Is government and Canada one of the same in this debate?
No, I don't think it is. I do think that there's definitely a partisan. There's a partisan nature here. Unlike what we did a year ago, we actually had we put in a federal ballot question into this poll. So we were able to look at this result broken out by, the various supporters of the supporters of the various parties. And certainly liberals see things quite differently. They're less inclined, although there is a significant amount of liberals who actually think the country's broken, but certainly not to the degree of conservatives and even not as high as the NDP supporters. We had a question that's, I would say, is a bit more of a partisan type question at the front end in terms of, are Canadians angry or happy about how the federal government's managing the country right now, managing Canada? So when you put in the federal government, you immediately think about, for some, the party in charge. And you saw, that break quite distinctly along party lines, where conservatives and NDPers were quite angry about how things are going in the country, whereas liberals are far, far less, which is really interesting when you think about how, based on partisan, you can have a completely different perspective on how things are going.
Yet that's not necessarily reflective in the polling. Are you anticipating a low voter turnout because it seems to be so divided? Do you think people will look at this and say, I don't think my guy's going to win, so I'm going to stay home rather than vote for the opposition?
I think it could be a little premature to start looking at voter turnout, but certainly we saw some signs of, on one hand, Scott, when you've got a population that's fairly exercised, like one in four Canadians are saying they're very angry about things.
So if they want change, they're going to show up?
they're going to show up. So that can actually drive up turnout. On the flip side, though, and we saw this certainly in 2011 when Michael Ignatieff was running against Stephen Harper, we saw a drop in turnout, and certainly, you know, lots of people, when they dissected the voting, a lot of liberals opted to, they weren't happy with the Liberal Party. They weren't happy with that leader and what the party was putting forward at the time. And, you know, and maybe a nod to Stephen Harper and doing a decent job, but they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Stephen Harper. So they stayed home. Might see a bit of that in this one for sure. But we'll have to see where things go over the course of the next at least a year. I don't think, as your song was saying, I think we're going to have to, you know, this is going to have to go for a while yet.
Yeah, we're in this for the long run. Andrew Enns, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger. A new poll conducted for the National Post. Many Canadians think Canada is broken. There you go. Andrew, thanks for the time as always. Be well.
Thank you, and likewise to you, Scott.
Canada's military in a recruitment death spiral. Those are the words of Defense Minister Bill Blair as he tries to wade through questions about the spending on Canadian military. As you might remember, there were statements, released through hacking that actually had quoted the Prime Minister as saying Canada will never meet its target of 2% for NATO and has no intention of doing so. Now that has seemed to take a complete 180, as with many things with this government, whether it's on housing, whether it's on healthcare, whatever, whether it's on pharmacare, what have you. But when you get the defense minister saying that the recruitment is in a death spiral, that's quite the admission. Let's bring in Dr. Jack Cunningham, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto, and here now. Jack, as always, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Hope you are too.
Jack, are you surprised? Yes, thanks so much. Are you surprised to hear a death spiral, that phrase coming out of the defense minister, Bill Blair? This seems to be a change of tone for this government.
I'm a little surprised, but I think it's significant that this remark came in a Q&A, not as part of a prepared speech, prepared and vetted by the PMO. There's an old joke that in politics, a gaffe is when you unintentionally speak the truth. Now, maybe this was a gaffe. Maybe it's the minister sending a signal to his colleagues that the situation is dire and needs to be addressed.
The Liberals will point to the F-35s in the upcoming purchase of those and say the government or the Conservatives didn't approve that. They kiboshed that. Is that accurate?
I think it's fair to say that neither party handled that particular purchase well, or that procurement generally has been handled well by governments of either party. And that is one of the reasons recruitment and even more so retention are problematic, with more people leaving the military than entering it. If you go into the military, you're not going to be well equipped. You're not going to have what you need to do your job. Our procurement process is so cumbersome and time-consuming that by the time we actually get some of this equipment, it's virtually obsolete. And that's obviously not an attractive work environment. The vacancies that exist are, I think, covered in terms of the budget. There is funding for them. People are just not applying. Partly because the application process is pretty cumbersome. The security screening takes a lot of time. And more broadly, perhaps because the military is not widely seen as a desirable career path.
You bring up a very valid point with that, Jack, because at one time it did. At one time, there were people who were using that. It was an opportunity for education. It was an opportunity as a career path. We know the U.S. certainly sells that a lot in their program. Forget defending ourselves and all that other. Isn't this a great opportunity for Canadians?
Well, it should be, there are shortages, particularly in highly qualified specialties, aviation specialists, communication specialists, medical officers. severe shortages in all those areas. So particularly in demanding fields where a fair amount of qualification is needed, people aren't joining. They don't see the benefit. There's also the fact that you join the military, you're going to move around a lot. You don't know where you're going to be deployed. It can be tough on family life. There's also the fact that in recent years, we've had these highly publicized sexual abuse scandals. We've had the government repeatedly talking about changing the culture of the military. I'm sure all of this helps discourage qualified women from applying, and it sort of reinforces the perception that there's something wrong with the military, that it's not something you'd necessarily want your kids to go into for a career. So while some people apply, a lot of them leave after a few years, go do something else. It's not seen as something that's particularly respected, regarded in well regarded in Canadian society. I think the official mythology that we're sort of an unmilitary people, which really flies in the face of our military history, has something of a hold on much of the public. And as a result, people just aren't applying, even though there are, in fact, significant opportunities in the military.
Blair says we need to do something differently, or we need to do things differently. What is that? What do we need to do differently? What is he suggesting?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the minister's suggesting, because he didn't really get an opportunity to elaborate on all of his remarks. But we need better pay, better benefits. We need more effort to accommodate family life and family stability in the military. We need better equipment so that we're not sending our soldiers out without the stuff on which they depend to fight and to protect themselves. And I think we also need to look at trying to make service in the military a source of pride rather than something that's perhaps a little disreputable. And that, I think, requires some degree of a cultural shift. And that sort of thing is difficult and takes time. So I don't see any silver bullet anytime soon. As for the spending aspect, it's true that the government has increased spending. But if you look at all the various plans for increasing it, most of the increases come in the out years. This government may not even be in power a couple of years from now. And crucial purchases of equipment keep getting deferred, keep getting stretched out. Increasingly, the military is looking like a somewhat under-resourced institution.
Many will blame past governments. You know, this has been on the decline since the Cold War ended. But post-pandemic, we certainly live in a different world now. We've seen that with China and with Russia. Can we keep using that line? We're in a different world post-pandemic, are we? Is that accurate?
Well, we've actually been in a different world since 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea in an age of intensified great power competition. And having influence in world events is not possible unless you're able to back up your words with hard power, reinforce your good talk with actual resources, and be able to credibly demonstrate to your allies that you have skin in the game, that you've brought something to the table, that you're not just a lot of empty talk. And that's something that I'm afraid governments of both parties have failed on. Ever since the end of the Cold War and even before, we were one of the laggards in NATO on our defense spending. And that's still the case. 1.2% of GDP, where France, which we don't think of as a particularly militaristic country, is around 1.94. Even Germany, which has constitutional limitations on its deployment of military forces, is close to 1.5. So our performance is egregious. It's been singled out. It's been noticed. There's a reason we weren't, for example, invited to join AUKUS.
Dr. Jack Cunningham with us, PhD program coordinator, Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History in Trinity College and the Monk School, University of Toronto. Defense Minister Bill Blair says that military recruitment in Canada is in a death spiral, more leaving than entering. Jack, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Take care.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can hear him, read him. No, hear him on the radio. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thank you for taking the time. I hope you are doing well.
Well, I am. Can I ask you a question? So I caught this earlier today, and maybe you can explain what the heck is going on, because I've not been able to find an answer. How is it that one of our citizens gets detained by China, and we are paying a settlement to this person? Explain this to me, because I don't understand this, and I can't find anybody who's explaining why it's coming out of our tax dollars.
Okay, here's what I got today from the guest that I had on, Charles Burton, Senior Fellow, Center for Advancing Canada's Interests
Abroad,
McDonald Lawyers. Yeah, great guy, great guest. So he said there is some sort of system in place of sharing information and sharing people who, names of people who share that information. So something happened, and we don't know what, something happened that Michael Spavor was scooped up in this. And apparently it was due to something or some involvement with the other Michael Kovrig and what he was up to. And somehow Spavor got sucked into this vortex and was pulled in as one of the hostages. So he said, if the government hadn't have done this with Kovrig, I wouldn't have been arrested. So you owe me money. And clearly they agree, or they wouldn't have given him the money. Now, I also asked the question, does the other Michael get money? And he said, possibly, but not as much. So from what I understand, there was a system in place for exchanging or sharing information. Somehow Spavor got roped into that through something he had or said with Kovrig, and then he got detained too. So Spavor went after the government for money and got it, and now we'll never know because there's a confidentiality agreement signed with all of this. But Kovrig probably got similar, but not as much, said the guest.
See, here's my argument on something like this. If a government, remember, the government has no skin in the game. They use our money to cover their mistakes.
Yeah.
A government, in my mind, should never be allowed to include a non-disclosure into an agreement, because it is public money. It is your money. It's my money. It's everyone else listening's money. And for them to then hide something that we can never know about, but while using our money, that should be, to me, that should be illegal. That should not even be allowed to be part of the process. You want to settle, and however, and I applaud you for making a good attempt at that explanation.
That's the best I got.
That's fine. I applaud you for that. But if you believe that you have screwed up enough that you have to pay a settlement, we as the public, as the taxpaying public, deserve to know how you screwed up, what you screwed up, and why you screwed this up. And then if someone in government did screw it up, what is the penalty to them or the consequence to them? Because once again, Scott, all that happens here is we get taxed more to pay for your mess, and then nothing ever happens.
And apparently this program that Michael Spavor was scooped up in is still in operation. So nothing's changed as a result of that.
There's a whole other discussion here about whether there should be real consequences to governments for mistakes the governments make. Because look, I understand government and private sector are not the same thing, but when a private company makes a mistake,
they pay.
And it's their money, it's their profits, it's their bonuses, it's their whole company could collapse. In the public sector, you screw up, you simply go back to the private sector and say, hey, we need more money to cover our boo-boo. And okay, and so who is being axed for this? Who's being fired for this? Well, I'm sorry, we can't tell you that because it's private, it's personnel matter. No, that is not nearly good enough. Scott, this goes back to, you know, like we were talking the other day here on the show, you may have well been as well, when we were talking about this medium security prison that Paul Bernardo is in. And you'll remember all the discussion back in the day when, you know, that whole thing with the tape of Carla, and how did Carla only get the thing she was? But at least we knew who the players were and what happened. In that one. This one, and that was a very public thing, nothing, I don't know whatever really came of it. This one, completely hidden, we don't know. And as you say, if this thing is still going on, this means we could end up paying more settlements down the road. Presumably.
I would agree with you 100%. And we all talked when the two Michaels were being held captive. We couldn't wait to hear their stories. I'm not sure we'll ever hear those stories.
I'm sure we won't. I'm sure we won't now, because if you put this in, because he would lose his entire settlement, presumably. I'm sure that's written into the contract if he speaks on this one. And once again, what if, Scott, what if this was just a colossal screw up by someone in government?
And, well, and considering the considering the amount of those that we have, committees, scandals, inquiries, it gets lost in the sauce. Like, there was stuff out today on the Emergencies Act. I mean, well, we still got to convoy people in court. There's so many of these. I think it just all gets lost in the sauce now, Scott.
It probably does. As I was sitting into the studio today, the TV was on, and I just happened to, out of the corner of my eye, see the Prime Minister. I don't even know what he was talking about. I just saw the word Trudeau defends something. And it's like, yeah, we're at this point now where every day is a defense of something. It's another committee being shut down. It's another scandal. It's another thing like this. And, you know, it's an outrage to me. We were talking about this yesterday on the show or the day before, I can't remember now. We now have something like 115 or 125,000 federal bureaucrats making over $100,000 a year.
Yeah, and they've increased by 30% in the time that he's been on board.
So that would suggest to you that the people who are running the government, the federal government, must be doing such an amazing job because they're being paid so handsomely. And yet every day it's another screw up that we're hearing about, and we can't do jack diddly about it because everything is either tied up or meetings are shut down or non-disclosure thing. Yeah, it's all
top
there's
secret.
Always something that we can't talk about.
It continues after 6 o'clock with the Scott Radley Show. Read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great one, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the tax-paying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from Steve. Fresh and free idea for you, Justin Trudeau. Instead of flailing your arms around, yelling in the House of Commons, blaming others for everything wrong in Canada, why don't you just call an election right now and show those darn conservatives just how stupid they are compared to the liberals? Keep right, accept a pass.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.